We are back on the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk Podcast on KCPW and KCPW.org. I'm your host, John Wildman, and I'm here with one of my co-hosts from Bitch Talk, Angela Tabora, and we are going to be talking about the slam dance film Tahara. And we've got a team with us. So we have Olivia Peace, we have Jess Seidman, we have Rachel Sennett, did I say it right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Madeline Gray DeFries, we always start, Olivia, we give you first dibs to tell our audience what the film is about.
All right. So Tahara is a film about generally like teenage girl friendship. And we start at a funeral. And it takes place over like one day at this funeral. And you watch a friendship kind of reach a climax point and then start to slowly fall apart. There's like a romantic encounter between like Carrie and Hannah. Who are our two leads, played by Rachel and Maddie. It's about grief and loss, but also just trying to find your way as an individual. Yeah.
All right. I will start off by saying I'm not even going to pretend. This is my favorite film that I have seen, both at Sundance and Slam Dance. I love this thing to death. I've bragged upon the film to everybody I've met.
He won't stop talking about it.
Can I just say, like, John, I don't want to interrupt, but thank you so much.
Oh, seriously.
In fact, I even told Ron Howard, who was here yesterday, that this was a film he had to watch.
Okay. Oh, my.
And he's only watched 40 films so far. So
yes.
Wow.
41 might be the one.
Hey. Yes. All right. But we have a lot to talk about. And Jess and Olivia, I want to start with the two of you. Because this is an incredibly clever script, and it's also incredibly tight, as we say, in the storytelling and what you do setting-wise. So I would love for the two of you to talk about working within the means that you had budget-wise and to keep things on track to tell the story in the way that you did.
I would love to talk about that. I actually wrote this script as a student at Northwestern University in a class called Writing the Micro-Budget Feature. So that sort of set up the confines of which it came to be. And I worked on it for the rest of my college career. And by the end, one of my other producers, Dasha Gorin, was in a class with me called Editing the Feature Script. And she turned to me and she was like, let's make this movie. And I was like, let's make this movie? And she was like, let's make this movie. So then comes the big independent film thing of just asking every favor you can. It's my dream to make a movie in Rochester, and we did it because that's where we got a synagogue to shoot in. We shot the entire movie in my childhood synagogue, Temple Beth El. Shout out to them. And I think the biggest thing that we played with is that we wanted to keep it intimate and small, the way that the story was told, both narratively, but also just logistically. We are all, you know, kind of figuring out our filmmaking path. So it's a good way to start in a way that we all, you know, can really learn and grow together as a crew. And not a huge budget means that you're really learning and growing together all the time. I think I'm really interested in figuring out the ways to play within those confines and make the most of it. Because I feel like that's a lot of what it feels like to be a teenager, honestly. You're like living in sort of your own bubble, and that sort of kind of is something I want to reverberate through the script and through the process of making the film.
All right. And Olivia, let's talk about getting the different colors and the hilarious levels that you got with your actors and how you balance that. Because actors come to that place at different times in different ways. Some need like 14 takes. Some are ready to go from the get-go. And, you know, and talk about how you manage them.
We got extremely lucky, both with Maddie and Rachel. They were such a joy to work with. Rachel comes from a comedy background, so a lot of improv actually happened on set with her. Maddie just has like this beautiful like sense of emotional depth, I think. And it was like such a joy to like grow. We had no time to rehearse.
Not
also
one day.
We had 15 days to shoot the entire project, and y'all just came on set and rocked it every single day. And we had a lot of local cast too.
We did.
That like drove in just for the shoot. It's really fun.
That's great. Yeah, yeah. I'd love to turn this to Rachel and Maddie. Can you talk about the process? Because as a kid in high school or elementary school, that first real best friend you have, I really look back on that, and few things are as intimate as that relationship. Mm-hmm. You know, you're discovering things together. You're learning about yourself together. So how were you guys able to accomplish this relationship in such a short amount of time, and what was that process like?
Well, I think we started out just kind of getting to know each other and kind of talk about our own experiences, like going through like high school and having like your crazy best friend.
Yeah,
and
well, I was talking to you. I mean, I think it's like that thing where you know where you're like, well, we should be friends.
And then we just like, sit at this table at dinner.
We literally go to like the hotel dinner bar or whatever, and we're like, okay, time to get the $9 wine and just sort of talk for 2 hours.
Let's just
until we know each other. Yeah. But I was talking to Maddie about how I had a friendship like this, like where one person, where my friend was really controlling to me, and it was so fun to kind of get to reverse those roles and be the controlling, manipulative one.
Mm-hmm. She needs to watch this film. Maybe.
I know. I said to her, I'm like, hey, you should watch this. No reason.
Yeah,
just
passive aggressive.
Watch it.
Yeah.
Does it remind you of anyone?
Yeah.
Well, you know, and as I was watching the film, like, I was thinking to myself, the Rachel, your character is one of the most hilarious sociopaths I think ever put on film. You know, but I also wanted to make sure that we talked about Madeline. You know, oftentimes the grounded character, it's really hard to get out of, you know, when you have such a colorful character that you're playing off of, to not literally be wallpaper.
Mm-hmm.
But your character's not. You're able to be very entertaining and give us levels, even though you are the practical, pragmatic person.
Right.
You are us watching the movie. And I would love for you guys to talk about beyond that, and also how you know, Olivia, also how you worked with the two of them to go beyond what are very funny lines that they have.
Thank you.
But to take that to a different level, because a lot of what I found hilarious was unspoken, you know, signals between the two of you. Go ahead.
Well,
we all got.
I think one of my favorite scenes that we did was when we're in the synagogue and we're like, just using our eyes to communicate. I remember doing that scene. It was like, I think we had like looked at the script one time, and then we were like, you know, let's just like,
you know.
And like Rachel is just so fun to play off of, because it's like she's just giving so much, and so
you were talking
so ridiculous that I can truly like have an honest like what the hell like kind of reaction back to her. And I think it's that like nonverbal scene, I think that was like really a lot of just our energies like having fun and playing
so
back
fun.
And forth.
Yeah, I feel like I also felt that a little with the bathroom scene. Mm-hmm. Which is a little less, I think it's a little more serious, but I feel like I always felt like you, when you're not saying anything and you're like looking at the magazine and your body language and everything, it's like I had so many like lines in a row where you would be like, no, this.
Yeah.
And it's like I because of all the like little things you were doing, it was so easy for me to like get aggravated and be like, give me your container or whatever.
I remember the lines, but
all
yeah,
right.
That.
Now let's move to the editing bay, because you got this awesome, hilarious footage. I'm sure you had more than you even, you know, you guys thought you would come out with, but you have to shape the story. So talk about the process there. You know what, you know, and again, you know, as you said, Jess, you guys don't have a lot of money to work with. You don't have a lot of time to spend forever in that editing bay.
No.
So talk about what that experience was.
That is true. I very naively thought that the film would be completely edited in September. And so now we're
And you
in
shot
here.
When?
And we shot in
May. We
May.
Shot
May. Okay.
Yeah,
right.
We shot for 3 weeks in May. And we really did sort of think September and we're chilling. You know?
That's not true.
Yeah. I don't know if Olivia wants to, Olivia, go for it.
Yeah. Well, the reason was because I was starting my MFA program. So now I go to USC. I'm in their interactive media and games program. So I wanted to be able to kind of complete the film and then start school. I ended up editing the film at USC, like in their in their basement editing lab. Shout out to them for letting me in.
Thank you.
Yeah, and so I edited a big cut of the film, and then Troy Lewis, my friend,
came in. He was on set with us, mm-hmm. and he edited the film live, like as we just had footage, he would take it and edit it. And he came in at the very end and just turned it into what you've been able to see. He did an amazing job. He's still here today, hopefully sleeping. He's so tired.
Yeah, I mean, I watched every cut. I've talked to Olivia on the phone as much as I could. I also work a full-time job, so we're juggling like one job, movie, other job, everything else. And so it was truly, and I live in New York. Olivia lives in LA. This movie is bi-coastal. And it was a lot of fun seeing it come together, but it wasn't, I always think, you know, as somebody who's been with this story since 2016 when I first wrote the first draft, it's changed so much, but it's always been the same story, and that has been like the guiding light of every edit, you know? We know what we want to focus on, we know what story we want to tell. So even though some lines need to go quicker, you know, everyone knows editing, it's always been like a joy to watch it take shape and still feel so like that first draft I wrote.
Yeah, I love that. And that's what I was going to ask you. Like, this was a project when you were at school, and now to watch it come to life and have all these strong women behind you making it happen.
Now
you're at Slam Dance. I just think that's a great story, and it's a good example, you know, for our listeners. Like, you can make it work. You know, you can make it work.
Yeah, it's a ton of work, but when you have the best people, and I have the absolute best people, it really does. It completely happens.
And, you know, and also when you write, especially when you're writing humor, you hear it specifically in your head. And it's hilarious what you hear in your head. Right? And, you know, and then you'll do readings, and you go, that didn't quite sound, you know, to the person that's not me reading this stuff. And, you know, and then when you see stuff performed, and then talk about it, because even in the best case scenario, that can be agonizing for a writer. So talk about that real quickly.
You know, I often feel very agonized when I have people workshop or read things out loud. But when we were doing auditions for this movie, I really was like, I'm so glad we are doing this. Because I think this movie exists in this place for so many people, young queer people, young Jewish people, who are experiencing just so much of their identity in media. And it's something people want to see and have seen, but we're making something new. It was cool to see that this is the story we were telling. And so even though I was like, oh, maybe that line has way too many likes in it, or maybe that line is way too long, it was still amazing to be like, wow, this is something people are excited about because it's a story they really want to hear and a story they really want to see.
Well, again, it's an absolute joy. I will continue bragging on it to every darn person I see. Again, the film is Tahara, screening at Slam Dance. We've had with us the director, Olivia Peace, writer, Jess Seidman, and the two stars, Rachel Senna and Madeline Gray DeFreeze. It's wonderful having you all here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We are back on the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk Podcast on KCPW and KCPW.org. I'm your host, John Wildman, here with one of my Bitch Talk teammates, Angela Tabora. And we're going to talk right now about the Slam Dance, in fact, the opening night film at Slam Dance, film about a father who. And we've got Lynn Sachs here. Lynn, it's great to have you here.
I am happy to be here. Yeah.
All right. We'd like to start by giving our filmmakers the opportunity to introduce our audience to the film. So tell us about your film.
Okay. I think in the context of being here with Bitch Talk, I have to say this is a film from a daughter's point of view and from a woman's point of view.
Hear, hear.
Thank you. I think that in so many ways, as women enter the film world, one sad thing that's happened is sometimes women erase their subjectivity. And so this really is my attempt to grapple with my place in my family in relationship to my dad, my attempt to express both rage and forgiveness. And as you bring those two together, that's kind of the only way you can move along in your life. And I don't mean ahead professionally, but ahead in finding your own stability and kind of maturity, and sometimes that takes a long time. And so if your art making practice can give you a chance to pull the pieces apart and put them together, and that happens through a film, then the film is giving back to you. So that's kind of what Film About a Father Who is.
Well, yeah, it is the most fascinating profile of an individual and their influence on the others around them. And regardless of the fact that it's the family of anyone, and it is a fascinating dynamic that you're able to capture. And you filmed this over how long? Tell our audience how long this footage was compiled from.
The very first footage that I shot was from 1984, when I was just kind of, let's say, claiming myself as a filmmaker. And I have to say, also in bitch talk language, we could say, yeah, women want to be directors, but directors means you have to buy into the whole hierarchy of the movie business. Mm-hmm. And I think filmmaker is kind of a pretty good way of claiming something that women always had, makers. So I haven't really said it that way, but when I see the signs for bitch talk.
Lynn, you're getting me riled up. Thank you. Go, preach on.
Preach on. Yeah, good.
Well, you know, and also, in case our audience hasn't picked up on it, of course, your brother is Ira Sachs. So naturally, there were, you know, I was, when I first started watching the film, I was going, well, of course, there are cameras always around between the two of you, you know, but yes, there is a unique viewpoint on your dad, and you know, who was this amazingly charming individual, but had layers that by your own account in the film were never easy to get under and were never easy to get through to, and that seemed like almost like a lifelong pursuit of yours.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting that you mentioned my brother, because he actually made a feature film that has shades of my dad, which is called 40 Shades of Blue. Mm-hmm. and I would say that for both of us, that the claiming of a kind of relationship to our dad also had to do with figuring out who we are. And actually, last night at the premiere, Ira stood up. I was excited. I had no idea what he'd say because he hadn't seen the finished film. And he said something that had to do with this film being about the search or the confrontation by a woman with masculinity. And I think we're in that moment in our society. We're actually in this sort of maybe, let's say, one step along in the Me Too moment, where we have to say, like, who are men to us? I have a daughter, and she, like, recently went through a period where she was very critical of all men. And I'd say, well, what about your uncle, or what about your dad? Things like that. And that became sort of just anecdotal and situational. But I think that the nature of masculinity means that you get a package, and it's not every man is this sort of heinous individual, and not every man has to erase, you know, the desire to be a man. And so there were many things about my dad that were like the essence of a kind of man I didn't want to, like, definitely didn't want to marry. But there was another side to him that was very, like, supportive of my work, and he never would miss a premiere, or we could have really good conversations about my friendships, and he would listen, and he was a good listener. He's not like the most outspoken person on a, like, that one-on-one kind of let's let it all hang out level, but he was a really good listener and was wise. And so I think that we're in a vital moment of discovering, like, what it is to be a man in the 21st century.
I love that you're talking about this, because I was just at a women's event last night, and we were talking about what happened with the Me Too movement. You know, everybody was all in and talking about it, and then it sort of fizzed, and then the Academy nominations come out, and it's like, oh, where did the women go? But it's like having these conversations, that's how we keep this movement ongoing.
Yeah.
And creating films with our voice, that's how we keep it going.
Yeah.
So thank you for bringing that up.
Well, thank you
so
for
important.
Saying, I just saw this popular movie, Bombshell. And, you know, it kind of upset me because it was presented as this feminist movie about, you know, these women on Fox television who one of them spoke out about the kind of sacrifices they had to make to get to the top. But yet the movie, you've talked about the form of the movie was so retro. You know, every woman had to be presented with the exactly the right makeup and the same blonde hair, and she couldn't break out of it cinematically. Mm-hmm. Like, it was so super, it was such a superficial way of saying, go Me Too movement. And mm-hmm. I was thinking, this movement is already past what they tried to do in that mm-hmm. movie.
Well, there's also something that you do in this film that, you know, I don't know if I would attribute it to gender or just you specifically. And it is how you capture the commiseration between your brothers and sisters, you know, and their relationships with your dad, and how those relationships evolved, and I found that incredibly, it's something that I hadn't really seen, and I thought incredibly special how you were able to capture that.
Actually, that really affects me that you say that, and I have to say this from a man's point of view, because I think that I wanted to listen to young men. I've always felt this way. Like, to be a young man in our age, you know, and try to find who you are, how to say, well, again, like, how to say, yes, I have desires, but how do I express them? And one of my brothers, Adam, he talks about that people would look at, you know, call my dad the Hugh Hefner of Park City. And then there were plenty of people who would say, oh, I aspire to that. If only, you know, if only I could attain that moniker. But yet he's also said, that's, in a sense, that's not the person I want to be. I don't want to be his son. And yet I admire him, but that's not like the way that I want to be. And I think all my brothers, so I have three of them, and have shades of their father, like we all do have shades of our parents, but then we have to mark ourselves and make distinctions.
Yeah, I agree with you, John. I think that was my favorite scene, is sort of this therapy session among siblings. And it was really powerful because you all have different levels of relationships, you know, granted, you know, at what level, you know, the eldest and the youngest. And one of your sisters says, you know, she's like, I don't like being around you guys because you're complaining about all these things, but you don't really know what struggle is. Mm-hmm. I grew up poor. You grew up, you know, in this home and that. And I think that that's also another really important aspect, is not only his effect on you personally, but his effect on your relationship with each other.
Yeah. Yeah. I will say that, you know, this whole idea that we all kind of wonder, you know, how do I live with a parent? And I don't mean live in a house, but live with them in our consciousness. And that, I think that scene, which was the first time that all of us were together, was a kind of, let's say, a visual or like manifestation, something of nine different views of the same person. And that's why one of the things that kind of kept me going this film was that it's not a portrait, it's a cubist portrait. So you come at him from the angle in which and where you're seated. So and that's one of the great things about cubism. It's not really about the face you see, it's the position from which you see that person, you know, and how do you express that? So I owe a lot to Pablo Picasso.
Well, let's talk a little bit about one of the, I mean, every film has a myriad of challenges, and the obvious challenge, you know, here is just the emotional connection to the subject and the film that you're doing. But, you know, we weren't part of your family. Your audience, you know, that saw the film on opening night, they're not part of your family. And so you have to distill all of this. You're in the editing room with all this footage, and to communicate this and talk about that, and you know, and you know, what it was like, and what were kind of like the hurdles for you to put the story together in a way that translated to someone other than yourself and Ira and Adam and your siblings.
I think that is very important. So as much material as any of us, media. Like, as we collect media, we create an archive. And the archive mostly is a happy one, because that's what people choose to document and to witness. They witness everything, but what they choose to share and to use to shape memory, and that's media shapes memory and memory shapes media, and it's kind of a back and forth conversation. But as we move along in the years, the media sometimes replaces the memory. So one of the things that I had to figure out was how to offer this material to people who hadn't lived it and didn't have anything invested in it, and for whom this story of this family wasn't just an idiosyncratic kind of wow story. I kind of wanted to move as much away from the wow, and there's a little wow, but as possible, so that you could say, oh, well, you know, I can enter this because I have this particular relationship with someone in my family that reminds me of this. I would never say that it helps, you know, you learn something from it, but it sparks some kind of ability to your maybe ability or desire to work on those things yourself and not to dismiss all the media. And so I think one of the things about making a film like this is that it's the transitions from one shot to the next where an audience could enter. It's like what you don't see, but you fill in those transitions, you fill them in, and they become like a synapse, and they connect to something you might have experienced.
Well, you definitely take the audience through a discovery process, you know, with this this portrait of your father. And again, the film the title of the film is Film About a Father Who. Slam Dance's opening night selection. We've been talking with Lynn Sachs, the director. It's been wonderful having you here.
Thanks for welcoming me.
The Festival Daily Buzz is brought to you in partnership with Films Gone Wild. You can find more info at filmsgonewild.com.
You're listening to the Festival Daily Buzz, and I'm your host, Angela Tabora, joined by my co-host, Lancia Wan. Welcome to our female shorts segment. We're really excited to have Ariane Labed, filmmaker of Ola. And from Take One Thing Off, we have Casey Bakumini, producer, and Scout Durwood, who is also a director and talent.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for being here. I want to start off with Ariane. Can you tell us a little bit about Ola?
So it's a short film that I did a year ago now, and it's set in France, where I come from, obviously, with my accent. And it's a story about a woman who arrives from Eastern Europe, from Ukraine, and she comes to France. We understand that she met this guy online, maybe to get married with him, and things just doesn't go the way she thought or he thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really love just how unapologetic this woman is. You know, she a lot of people would come into a new situation like that and just kind of succumb to what is expected of her as a woman. But I just love the fierceness of her, and she's like, nope, this is not me, I'm out.
Exactly, that's it. Yeah. The way you describe it is exactly that. Yeah, she's I wanted to create a character who doesn't do any compromise, and she follows her intuition, and she's strong, but just by instinct, and she's able of a lot, and she doesn't just try to please people, but she's very truthful to herself.
And Ariane, this is also, you premiered at Cannes,
yeah,
and this is going to be the first time you're showing it to a U.S. audience where you're actually here, is that correct?
Yeah.
How are you feeling?
I'm so scared. No, I'm always scared when I show my film anyway, because, you know, I feel very, very exposed and naked, but that's part of it, because I'm, you know, you do film socially to people, so it's always exciting, and then it's a new audience for me. It's a new, I guess people are gonna receive it in a different way than in Europe, and I'm very excited, and I can't wait to have feedback from people.
Awesome. And I wanted to pair these two different films together, because you guys have similarities, yet they're very different projects completely. So maybe, Scout, if you want to talk about Take One Thing Off.
Yeah, Take One Thing Off is a 22-episode digital series. It's 11 music videos and 11 kind of comedy vignettes
we did it with my music label in Los Angeles. It's super fun. It's a very, we call it an existential odyssey or a digital series of existential proportions. But it's kind of just like my musings on the world, and things are a little backwards. I think we can all agree. There's at least one thing we're like, how is this the system? So that's kind of the premise of the series.
And I remember reading something about how you described this entire series as be the strange you wish to see in the world.
Yeah.
Which I think applies to both of you.
Yeah. Okay.
Kind of connects with that. From different perspectives. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I really loved it, Scout, because it was kind of just like peeking into your journal and being like, what's she thinking today? Because from each episode, I'm like, what is even going to happen now?
Right.
You know, you don't really know what to expect. And that's what I love, is just like the sheer absurdity of it, but also there's a thread. I mean, it makes sense. And for you, Casey, how did you get joined with Scout in this project?
In the most professional way. We met on a basketball league.
And I will say now, nice. we are both lesbians. We met in a basketball league. It's just plain sports.
Women's only Tuesday night recreational basketball league.
We I love it.
Got paired. I joined the team, and there was other lesbians on the team, and Scout just happened to be one of them.
It was
what are the odds?
Yeah, I know, right? On a sports team, there were more. Yeah, it was kind of a perfect storm, and my label was so great. They gave me a little bit of money, and they kind of gave me the time and flexibility to do what I wanted with it. And Casey had not produced before and did a really incredible job of, like, I mean, we really just, like, I don't know the expression for it, but whatever, bad initiation. Like, we really rushed her into the...
Into the clan.
Yeah. Because it was just the whole thing was like, we got this. And I think there was a lot of hubris in it and kind of going, come on, we don't need money. We can do this. Our DP, John Gardner, was so great at kind of going like, nope. And then we'd be like, okay, no, but we can do something else. And so I'm so thankful that Casey was really had the flexibility and stern but kind hand to make it happen.
And Casey, Scout did mention that this was sort of your first time producing, but you have been in front of the camera before. and after being in behind the camera and behind the scenes right now, did you just form your own production company as well?
I did indeed. Wow, you really have done your research. yes, I did not enjoy being on the camera as much as I really do enjoy being behind it. And because of Take One Thing Off, I caught the bug and telling stories. And, you know, Scout does something that is really amazing, which is she has a very clear vision and a creative voice, and she takes that with her. And you can see all the people that kind of gather around and find joy in that, and I would love that too.
So. You touched that kind of being your authentic self, you know what I mean? I think that can be really... There's so much value in that as a filmmaker, because you really are the only person with your own voice, whether that's stream of consciousness or you know...
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and Ariane, you started as an actress, and you have many wonderful credits to your name, including a Volpe Cup Award, is that right?
Yeah.
And that's, you're only one of two actresses to win this award, so it's fairly prestigious from what I understand.
Yeah, thank you.
Where is it? You didn't bring it? You should wear it around.
Like a necklace. Like big like that. Heavy, but no.
But I'm still an actress, actually. I'm not.
Yeah, you're still in a bunch of upcoming things as well. But this was sort of your first directorial debut as a short. And it was shot on 16mm.
Right. Oh, wow.
Which is quite the creative choice. But can you kind of talk about your process, about how you came into this project, why you wanted to direct, what it was that made you shoot on film rather than video, and et cetera?
So I always wanted to direct. It just took me time because I love acting as well, and I was doing one project after another. And I was always saying, I'm going to do that one day, but I needed to take the time for it. It took me 2 years to do a short film, so I need to take the time. And but I always had it in the back of my head. When I did my first film at Edinburgh, I just realized that I knew that one day I want to direct as well. And so I started writing, and I don't know exactly how I come up with this story, but that's what happened. And it's kind of, I don't really feel that I started a new thing in my life, becoming a writer and director. For me, it's the continuation of my work as an actress as well, because I always try to choose my roles and the people I work with for the same reason why I did my film. It's one thing, it's not being in front of, behind the camera for me, it's one project, and it's my work as an artist in general. So I don't feel like it's my first film.
Awesome.
Really.
Yeah. There's so many films that you've done before. And as someone told me once, it was a producer that said that shorts are harder than features.
It's I don't know, I haven't done features.
I disagree with that. Oh my God. No, the second season is more of a feature, and it's a behemoth. I mean, it is a beast. Features are a beast.
For sure, but the time it took me, that for me, it's more about frustration somehow. It took me 2 years, and then I had 5 days of shooting, and I was like, oh no, give me like a feature film now. I'm ready for it.
Yeah.
Just felt like so hard to just get that. And it's hard to create. For me, it was hard to write a character for in 27 minutes and to try to develop the character, you know, for it to be strong enough for people to get it. So it was a difficult exercise, but I guess it was my first thing as a director, so everything was difficult.
Yeah, yeah, you're cramming everything into a short amount of time versus a feature where you have a lot longer to talk and develop that story. But you're a trained dancer, Ayan, and did you put a little bit of yourself into the character as well? Scout obviously did.
We can talk about but specifically that dance when she's dancing in the living room. Did you choreograph that?
Yeah, I did. It's nice. Based on a Pina Bausch choreography.
I love that
mixed with like striptease type of moves, and it's a mix of things that I love, and we created that.
It's so good.
Yeah, that was my. I took so long for this scene because it was for me the heart of the movie. And then just quickly about the 16 millimeter, for me it was very important to shoot in 16 because there is, except of the aesthetic part of it, because it's, I think it's beautiful and creates also, it fictionalized the topic somehow. And I didn't want it to be a social drama or a documentary as a language. So for me it was very important to create frames and something very pictorial in it. And I love the process of shooting in film because it's when you don't have money, you know that the time is very precious, and I love that.
Well, Scout, I wanted to talk about just the difference in each from episode to episode. Obviously, you have these really fun and funny music videos, but I also love the diatribes that you go on. I mean, that my favorite episode, I think, is when you're schooling the generic cis white man on what real lesbianism is.
Oh,
and
yeah,
that's just one of my favorite episodes. And then you also schooled, I was watching it with some of our crew here, and the palm trees. You're talking about the palm trees in L.A., is this true?
This is so true.
As a Los Angelino, I was devastated.
I knew that they were not native trees.
They're not native.
They're not native, but you broke a horrible fact. That
That's my goal, really, is to take anything that people enjoy and shatter that joy.
Yeah, so it was also a learning with enlightenment experience for me, and I haven't been the same since. So
it's
thank you.
Brutal.
You're going to have to watch it to find out. I think it's episode 7.
Yeah, Allison Scaglione's not him.
Yeah, to find out about the palm trees in LA. So anyway, we'll leave it with a cliffhanger.
Thank you guys all so much. We are the Festival Daily Buzz on KCPW. We were just talking with Ariane Lebed from Ola, Sundance Short, as well as Scout Durwood and Casey Bokumini from Take One Thing Off. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Welcome back to the Festival Daily Buzz. I am Erin, and I am joined by Justin Simeon and Elle Lorraine from the film Bad Hair. I was able to sit through last night's premiere, and I'm not going to talk about this film first. You talk about this film, Justin.
Wow, okay.
I wouldn't do it justice, so.
Yeah, so it is, it's a movie about a killer weave, literally, that takes place in 1989, which was sort of kind of the inception of the weave into popular culture. And, you know, it's really my take on psycho thrillers, like particularly that kind of 70s style, Brian De Palma era, movies like Carrie and Body Snatchers and Body Double and but black, and wanting to sort of use those techniques of that genre to kind of interrogate and pick apart, you know, the experience of being a marginalized person, particularly being a black woman. As well as I could from my perspective. And I got a chance to showcase who I think is just one of the most exciting actors that, you know, people hopefully will know a lot more of now that this movie's been made. So,
Sweet. And Elle, can you talk about, you get this script.
Yeah, I get this script.
And then what?
And then I like I sat by myself and I read it and I connected to it immediately. And I was like, I have to do this. How can I, you know, how can I embrace this character to the fullest and show up in every way possible? And Justin actually made me a little nervous because he was like, do the work. Do the work. Come to that audition ready. You know what I mean? Yeah. Because so many people wanted this role because he's brilliant. Mm-hmm. And the role gave people an opportunity to really go deep and to just go into a world that we haven't seen in a capacity we haven't seen with people we haven't seen.
Right.
And so, yeah, I got to do it. I got to be a part.
And Justin, to talk about the script and the story, can you rewind a little bit and just talk about the process and the layers
sure.
that you included into the story? Because there's a lot of layers.
There's a lot. I always bring a lot. I'm a lot. No, I mean, it really started with a conversation about Korean and Japanese horror films, particularly a subgenre of hair horror. A movie called The Wig in particular sparked some conversation between me and the producers of Dear White People. And I've just really always loved that genre and felt like there was an American story, you know, to be said about hair. And so I sort of began figuring out what that might be. And it started with a lot of conversations with Black women in my life. I felt like I couldn't really tell this story just from my own perspective. And it felt like every conversation I had, and I had many, it felt like there was this, Black women in my life felt like they were always getting these sort of fake choices between a chance at freedom and success or their ambition and sort of like being completely unseen and buried. And yeah. every time they took that opportunity, there was like a pin in it. There was like a hidden cost. And so the movie is kind of designed to sort of pull you through this environment that seems like maybe if you work it the right way, you can get all the way to the top, but actually, you know, it's set up to ensnare you even further. And so I just kind of went from there, and I sort of decided 1989 was gonna be the year because that really was sort of the first time that weaves kind of made it to the popular culture, that everyday women were able to get them. And the music of the period is so interesting because it's stuff that we all remember so fondly, but there are these little messages in the music and in the culture, even in the culture that Black people love and celebrate, that sort of is a part of the oppression. And so I don't know, I just thought I could kind of pick it apart from all of those different angles, and that's what we attempted to do.
Yeah, and can we talk about the music and the outfits?
Can
and
I talk yes, about the music?
Please.
First, I want to say, Justin wrote so much of the music.
Yes.
Did you know that?
Well, so I'm of a certain age, and I know some of the music that you had in there. And then those parts where they were kind of made up for the film, I'm like, but it felt like that time and place.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
All of Kelly Rowland's, every song she did, and then there was a guy group, and then
The Fellas,
and then Justin also did a song. And he wrote all of the music, and if you listen to the lyrics, it's one of the things I just loved that you said. It's so layered because it really narrates a lot of the story.
Mm-hmm. It's always there.
And it's so complex. Yeah, it's always there. And a lot of the songs kind of get in your mind and seep in just as a lot of the messages do.
Yeah, they kind of function like a little like Greek chorus, you know? But it's sort of stuff where it's like, yeah, that sounds like a bop. But then you listen to the lyrics like, wait, that's incredibly misogynistic and kind of rapey. But we're all like in it and we're feeling it. And I just wanted to sort of, I just wanted to kind of shine a light, sometimes with humor, sometimes with horror, on those things that we don't realize are actually, you know, ensnaring us.
Yeah. And can we talk more about the story of the political portion of this, the folklore of hair, and just both of your perspectives about that and no pun intended, weaving it into the story. I really
that was good.
Sorry.
Well, you know, I did a lot of research on the things Justin had researched for the movie, and I have my own experiences culturally and as a woman, and also being in entertainment and having to make those sacrifices myself. I remember when I first moved to LA, I don't know if you remember this, the first time I got a weave, and there was a certain level of needing it in order to present myself, and even just in auditions. And so there were small sacrifices that I had to make. So I related to this character very easily. And I've watched the women around me have to adjust themselves and change their own ideas of beauty so that they could get further in their careers. And yeah. And so even like doing the research and reading all the stories that you read and talked about, it spoke so much to our history. It spoke so much to the things that I didn't even realize were in my psyche, you know? And yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And I thought, you know, one of the tragedies of, there are many tragedies of being marginalized in America, yeah. but one of the ones about, you know, specific to Black people is that we are so cut off from our history and from the stories that we've been trying to tell ourselves through the generations. And there's a rich tradition of African folklore that served as inspiration for some of the kind of supernatural elements of the film. And, you know, one of the things you kind of feel, or at least I hope you feel, is that if only Anna could sort of get an understanding of the wisdom that was sort of kind of cut away from her. Mm-hmm. Maybe she would have enough resource to sort of get through this thing okay. Because, you know, really that to me is like one of the greatest tragedies of slavery is that there was so much that was lost, mm-hmm. even though slavery, of course, does not exist currently in a form that we recognize anyway.
I was going to say, certainly well, the industrial
prison complex.
Yeah, we
could
have a conversation about that.
Yeah, it still finds its way. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as a free, quote unquote, free Black person, I'm still also alienated from myself mm-hmm. in ways that I'll never know, mm-hmm. you know.
And the tradition of keeping secrets, which I think you point out so beautifully in the movie, yeah. Which women, people of color, you know, a lot of us experience, like, in secrecy, even within our familial units a lot of times. And later we grow up and we're like, this was happening? I had no idea. Had somebody told me, I wouldn't have had to relive what you've already gone through, or maybe I would have had a little more information about myself to be a little further, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of times it's left up to us, whether it's our generation or the younger ones, to change that and start speaking out loud.
Yeah.
And I think this movie questions that, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, again, the layers. I mean, yeah. You could just watch it and it's a horror film, but then when you're really reading into it, and especially tying in the Indian portion of the story, Native Americans,
yeah.
and tying it in with slaves and just all of that. I mean, well, of course.
I really wanted to make something that felt like a ride the first time through, but that maybe pulled you to watch it again because, you know, my favorite movies of this genre are sort of like 3D puzzles. It's like the first time you watch The Shining or something, you know, which is a freaking masterpiece, you almost don't even know what you watched. It's almost like the eighth time I've watched it, I kind of start to understand what it's actually about and meaning. And I just wanted to just put in enough to sort of warrant repeat viewing and repeat thinking and repeat conversation about the film.
I can't wait.
Honestly, I learned watching it last night, I learned a few things too, which is crazy. Yeah. I'm like, oh, okay, that clicked for me in a different way.
Yeah.
And of course, we have to talk about the cast. I mean, Vanessa Williams.
Isn't she amazing?
Everyone was amazing. Top notch. MC Light. I mean,
yeah, I mean,
please talk about it.
Judith Hall.
And
Michelle Hurt.
When all of these names were coming through, were you like, okay, this is happening.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's going to be powerful.
Yeah. Carmen Cuba was our casting director. She did a great job. And it was just sort of, you know, that thing where you're looking for someone who's going to give you what's on the page, but also surprise you, but also just be great to work with. And I'm just grateful that, you know, all of those people existed and wanted to do it. And like Kelly Rowland and Laverne Cox and James Vanderbeek and Blair Underwood. It's like, I was really touched by their connection to the material and their willingness to play and experiment and find this strange movie with me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're a part of it, so
it's
history.
I was honored. I was honored to be there and to be on the other side of them acting was a lesson. I was getting lessons galore. And I remember during our early shooting, we did some of our first scenes with Blair Underwood, and he was doing some things, and I was literally like, oh, and like, oh, I'm supposed to be working, you know, and you know, everyone else, like, but honestly, it was a masterclass for me. And even names you don't know, like Yanni and Ashley Blaine Featherston, they were wonderful and incredible and sacrificed themselves, and you can see it in the work.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, we've been talking about the film Bad Hair with Justin Simeon
and
Lorraine. Yeah. Can't wait for everyone to see it.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. Go see it.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you for having us. Yeah.
And that's a wrap on today's edition of the Festival Daily Buzz on KCPW and kcpw.org. This show is made possible with partnerships with the Slam Dance Film Festival, GoTo Productions, and KCPW Radio. In-kind donations are provided by Pro Bar, Keto's Brewing, and The Market, Park City. Our audio producer is Charlene Godo. Social media help was provided by Shoshana Howard. And assisting us in production are Chris Gardner and Brian Silverman. Our executive producer is Lancia Wan. Thanks for listening.